It is Wednesday, June 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, the man convicted of carrying out the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing breaks his silence. A VOA reporter tells us how the families of the victims reacted in court. U.S. President Obama changes his policy on dealing with hostage takings of Americans. And Kurdish rebel gains against Islamic State militants in Syria raise concerns.
We're starting to see the expansion of a Kurdish north, and that is going to make a resolution of the Syrian problem all the more difficult.
It's all ahead on International Edition. Boston Marathon bomber Jokhar Tsarnaev has been formally sentenced to death for the 2013 attack that killed three people and wounded 264 others. A U.S. federal judge officially imposed the death sentence on Tsarnaev Wednesday. The penalty already had been recommended to the judge by a 12-person jury last month. Tsarnaev was given an opportunity to speak publicly before the sentencing, and he took it, apologizing to the victims and survivors of the attack. It was the first time we had heard from him in court, and VOA Russian service reporter Fatima Tlisova was there when it happened. I asked her earlier how people reacted.
Inside the courtroom, there was a deep, deep silence while Jokhar Tsarnaev was speaking. There was emotion, though. You could see it on the faces of the victims. Everybody who was in the courtroom was moved, even when after Jokhar Tsarnaev finished, Judge O'Toole started speaking, and his voice was breaking several times. He needed to stop and then continue because his voice was obviously breaking. So there was an emotion inside the courtroom.
And does that emotion mean that the people in the courtroom were persuaded or convinced by what Tsarnaev was saying?
I can't say how much they were convinced, but it can be only an observation or even an opinion that it was a much-needed apology because several victims this morning called upon Jokhar Tsarnaev, trying to convince him that this is going to be his last chance to show remorse, to apologize, to ask for forgiveness, and he did use that chance, actually. So I think for the victims, it was important to hear his apology, finally. It was a very, very important point for them.
Of course, the death sentence was not a surprise because the jury had decided earlier that he should be sentenced to death. But what I'd like to know is, what are the chances that Tsarnaev will appeal this death sentence?
Well, at the end, actually, after Tsarnaev finished his speech, he actually spoke in a very good English, but a distinct Chechen accent. He was very polite. He referred to Allah a lot. And after he finished, his lawyer, Judy Clark, she asked the judge about the proceedings for the appeal. So I guess they will be going to appeal, but we don't know for sure yet. There was no statement.
And that was VOA's Fatima Tlisova in Boston. Well, there's been quite a bit of reaction to the Tsarnaev apology on social media. Andrew Palchevsky joins us for a look at that. Andrew, has the reaction been positive or negative?
Well, the reaction, it's been interesting because we've kind of had a month or so since he was sentenced by a jury of his peers last month. They came back with the verdict that he was going to be sentenced to death, but today was the formal sentencing. So over the past month, you've had people kind of talking about it and then reinvigorated today as the formal sentence came down. The comments that we're seeing on social media range from everything from too little too late. He said he was sorry and people are not buying that. Somebody pointed out on Twitter that he admitted guilt for the bombing, but then he pled not guilty at the start of this trial, so they're pointing out that discrepancy. Other people saying, I'm not sorry, I'm not accepting his apology. And because we live in a social media age, we're, in addition to getting these reactions, we're getting photos and video. And the one video I saw was interesting was a Vine video. After the verdict was formalized, his defense team kind of walking out of the side entrance of the courtroom, not even going through the main entrance, with their heads hung. And I think someone shouted out and asked for a comment, and they just refused to give any kind of comment. This was a big loss for them.
They seemed disappointed.
Yeah, and it's interesting that they knew what was going to happen a month ago. I guess there could be some elements of surprise. The judge could say, no, I'm not giving you the death penalty, but I think that's very rare for a judge to go against what a jury has decided. But again, it's, you know, you see political cartoons. You saw there was a picture that came out during the trial of Jokhar Tsarnaev giving a camera in the court, in the jail, a middle finger gesture. And so people were using that picture saying, oh, are you really sorry? Is this how you show that you're sorry?
It seems to be a lot of skepticism out there.
A lot of skepticism, not a lot of sympathy for him, even though he tried to, I guess, garner some of that today by saying that he was sorry, saying that he admitted guilt for his actions. But people certainly on social media were not buying it.
Andrew Palchevsky, thanks for that update.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new is the winner of the DARPA Robotics Challenge, Team South Korea. The contest, sponsored by the Pentagon, is an effort to develop robots that may someday help when catastrophe strikes. Gil Pratt is with the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
This is really about trying to make robots effective for helping first responders in emergencies, particularly when there's a disaster, that you can make the disaster less severe.
This robotics contest in Pomona, California, was an idea born from the rubble of the 2011 meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan. Here's Gil Pratt.
If robots had been available back then, they could have gone in there and made the disaster much less severe.
The South Korean team won $2 million, beating 22 other teams. But all the robots are still too undeveloped to be effective when it comes to helping first responders in disaster conditions. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. U.S. President Barack Obama says his administration will no longer threaten American families with criminal charges for trying to negotiate with terrorist kidnappers or for paying a ransom to win freedom for hostages. Mr. Obama made the announcement after a six-month review of U.S. policy on dealing with hostage takings of Americans. Our White House correspondent Aru Pandey is on the line with us now. Aru, what is the latest on the policy change?
Well, Michael, this is an effort that has been going on for 6 months now, and President Obama today announced the findings of this review that he carried out. Basically, what we have are families of hostages overseas who've said that they're incredibly frustrated with the process of trying to get their loved one back home safe. They felt that there were too many departments and agencies involved. They were getting no information or being told that they should consult different agencies. Some wanted to maybe perhaps pay a ransom and were told that they might be criminally prosecuted. Other agencies told them, well, we'll help communicate with the hostage takers. So they were getting mixed messages. They felt, you know, the Foley family, the parents of the journalist James Foley, came out and said, look, we felt abandoned. We felt like the government didn't care. So this really is an effort that's been going on for months. The president himself met with the families of about 40 hostages currently and former and talked to them about, you know, what recommendations they offered and how they can get the support they need going forward.
Well, I understand that the administration faced some tough questioning about that policy change at the White House press briefing today. What came out of that briefing?
Well, basically, what the president made clear today is that while the government will help facilitate communication and will not prosecute any families who are willing to pay a ransom to hostage takers, the U.S. government policy of no concessions toward terrorists will not change, which means the U.S. government will in no way pay any ransom to hostage takers or terrorists overseas. Now, during the White House press briefing today, the president's Homeland Security Advisor, Lisa Monaco, fielded a number of questions from journalists who said, well, look, if the terrorists are getting money from a family, why does it, and they can't get it from the U.S. government, it doesn't matter either way that the terrorists are getting money. You know, so they tried to get the government to basically parse this distinction. Sure, the U.S. government won't pay ransom, but if you're saying that the families can, either way they're getting the money.
Right.
And Monaco basically, she didn't really answer the question directly. She again reiterated the no concessions, and she said, look, we're just here to help. We want to make sure that the families don't feel abandoned. We're here to facilitate communication, but we're not here to facilitate ransoms. So she didn't directly answer that question. I mean, the president was very clear that paying ransom to terrorists overseas is a national security issue and would basically endanger more Americans and fund the very terrorism that the United States is trying to stop.
Right.
So there was that anomaly there. I mean, there was no distinction made. Okay, fine, we're not going to prosecute families, and we have not prosecuted families, but at the same time, the U.S. government stands by its policy. So if you're someone holding an American overseas, you're going to demand ransom either way. If you're demanding it, you're going to get it if the families are willing to pay it.
That does sound like the dilemma facing the administration.
Right.
Well, Aru Pandey at the White House, thanks so much for that update.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Now, the Obama administration is taking partial credit for recent gains by Kurdish forces in northern Syria against Islamic State fighters, some of whom have kidnapped Americans. On Tuesday, Kurdish-led forces claimed to have captured Ain Issa, about 50 kilometers north of Raqqa, the capital of the self-declared IS caliphate. The Kurdish rebels, known as YPG, or People's Protection Units, have been helped by U.S.-led coalition airstrikes. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke earlier to RAND Corporation Middle East analyst Ben Connable and asked Connable about the risks that could come with a Kurdish military success in Syria.
I think the problem is that we're starting to see the expansion of a Kurdish north, and that is going to make a resolution of the Syrian problem all the more difficult, because if the Kurds do carve out their own space in northern Syria, there are going to be a considerable number of other Syrians who are not going to be happy with it.
Among all the reports I read, there is no indication of what their ultimate objective is. They're considered Sunni and moderate. What ultimately do you think is their goal?
Well, I think they are trying to probably carve out their own territory, which makes a lot of sense, and probably from a political standpoint, from a security standpoint, I think if anybody were in their shoes, they would probably be doing the same thing. The question is, how is that going to resolve whatever other issues are there, and are they doing any kind of ethnic cleansing that we've seen in northern Iraq and southern Iraq in Syria? I think there haven't been any significant reports of that I've seen, but that's something we need to watch out for.
What is their key to success, do you think?
Well, it's the small unit cohesion and fighting power that's generated by people who want to fight and win. I think they're motivated by the fact that they've lost their home territory. Their families were turned into displaced persons, and they believe that they're fighting for an eventual Kurdish homeland. That kind of fighting power gives you great strength, and we see on the other end across the border in Iraq, the Iraqi army not doing well, really not having much to fight for, not really believing in certainly the fight that's taking place in the Sunni areas.
They're being helped by U.S. coalition airstrikes. How is that being coordinated? How successful is that combination?
I don't know exactly how they're coordinating it. I'm sure that there's some kind of assistance that's being given there. Don't know how direct that is, but the U.S. is able to identify targets without ground assistance to a certain extent, and I think some portion of the airstrikes are certainly being done without any coordination at all. I think when the Kurds are fighting in tight urban terrain, so this is my estimation, that they are probably communicating the forward line of troops to the U.S. to ensure that their forces are not struck by coalition air power.
And that was analyst Ben Connable with International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
U.S. and Japanese researchers have discovered 854 ultra-dark galaxies located within the Coma Cluster, about 321 million light-years from Earth. Dark galaxies contain or are composed of dark matter that cannot be seen by telescopes. The researchers say that these galaxies became dark after they lost gas needed to create new stars sometime during or after their formation billions of years ago. While these newly discovered galaxies do contain some visible light, the researchers say that it only amounts to about 1% or less of the total mass of each galaxy. The remaining 99% of the total mass is thought to be dark matter. While dark matter can't be seen, its existence can be implied from the gravitational effect it has on visible matter. The astronomers were able to make their discovery by analyzing archival data from Hawaii's Subaru Telescope. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. France is sending its intelligence coordinator to Washington following allegations by the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks that the U.S. spied on the last three French leaders, including current French President François Hollande. In 2013, WikiLeaks had reported that the U.S. National Security Agency had wiretapped German Chancellor Angela Merkel's private phone. VOA's Sarah Williams spoke today with Dominique Moisy, a senior advisor to the French Institute for International Relations in Paris, and asked him if the latest allegations of U.S. spying on France are surprising.
Well, not surprised, because we knew, given the fact that Chancellor Angela Merkel was listened to, that the French presidents also were of interest for the NSA. But at the same time, a sense of shock and displeasure. This is not a way to treat an ally. And so, yes, a feeling of what's gone wrong with America, what has happened to a system that seems to be escaping any diplomatic common sense. You don't want to show your ally that you distrust them so much, that you want to make sure that you know whatever they be saying.
Well, and France is not just any U.S. ally. It is the U.S.'s oldest ally and aided the U.S. during its War of Independence.
Yes, and also right now, for many people in Washington, France has replaced the United Kingdom as the deputy sheriff of America when it comes to security and military intervention.
Have there been concerns, because as you mentioned, there was accusations against eavesdropping in regard to German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Have relations between France and Germany been impacted because of these allegations?
Well, these allegations do not create, I repeat, a warm climate of friendship between close allies. We need each other, and you don't want to treat Paris or Berlin as they are treated by Moscow, or as you yourself treat Moscow. So somewhere, something went wrong in the decision-making process in Washington. Who gave the order? Who checked? Who decided? And it would be very interesting to know the chain of command.
By any chance, do you think France would call for an investigation of this?
Well, France will call for an apology, and a formal one would be better than a subdued private one. And I think apologies are needed. And then, of course, France and the United States need each other too much. They will remain close friends and ally, but this will leave a little scar, and this was, to say the least, unwelcome.
And that was Dominique Moisy speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. And now it's time for a look at the music world with David Byrd.
You might have seen them on The X Factor. You might be familiar with some of their other works, but they've got a new song out called Black Magic. They're a girl group known as Little Mix, and Larry London joins us in the studio. Larry, Little Mix started out as not as a group, but as individuals competing on The X Factor.
You could call them the female One Direction. Same story for One Direction. Simon Cowell discovered a bunch of solo artists that didn't make the cut, put them into a group, and then bang, they became very successful. So that's the story behind Little Mix. They were once known as Rhythmix, but now they're Little Mix, and they're coming out with their third album.
Now, this song, Black Magic, I watched the video for this, and they kind of played up, you know, it's four nerdy girls in college, and then they discover this book of incantations or whatever. Suddenly, they become, like, super hot, sexy pop babes, you know, like, it's really kind of comical, the way they transform, you know. But one thing I noticed in this, the music in this particular tune reminded me of a lot of pop songs. Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody, Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun, even like Hold On by Wilson Phillips. Now I'm really going back in the
You're
day.
You're digging, Dave.
I'm digging deep. But, you know, it's just kind of like you're listening to the tune and all of a sudden these little things are going, wait a minute, my musical memory is pinging.
Right.
Is this formulaic, do you think? Or do you think it's just all pop songs kind of have several common elements to
Well, it's good that you asked that because it was an intentional effort on their part to try and recapture the 80s sound. That's what they were going for, the 80s sound. And so they were very successful, obviously, with the artists and the songs that you just mentioned. That's right on target.
Well, now, an interesting thing I found out about this group, too, is that they actually wrote the song that Britney Spears and Iggy Azalea have on the charts, which is Pretty Girls.
Pretty Girls. Not doing too well. But
it's not doing too well, but they wrote it.
Yes. And they're very talented songwriters. In fact, they wrote this song that's featured on their new album that it leaked. The song leaked. It was supposed to come out in May. Or actually, it was supposed to come out in July,
right?
But it somehow leaked on the internet in May. So now the record label is stuck with a situation, so they're putting it out now.
Mm-hmm. So anything we can look for from the future of these girls? I mean, you mentioned One Direction. In One Direction, some of the guys are going in different directions.
Right, right.
But these girls seem to be in it for the long haul, right?
And there's an ironic twist to this, because Perry Edwards from the band is engaged to Zayn Malik from One Direction.
Who left One Direction.
And she was the villain. The rumor why he left was that she was jealous and he wasn't spending enough time with her. And so then he left and they're together and they're happy and they're getting married. But, you know, there was a connection there between those two artists beyond just being on the X Factor.
All right. Well, that's VOA's Larry London. You know, you can always contact Larry on Twitter. That's at VOA underscore music. If you want to hit us up here on International Edition, that's at VOA underscore IE. You can find Larry doing border crossings by going on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. That's where you'll have all kinds of interesting folks to talk to, hear from, hear their music from. And just check it out.
And that's VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sexual violence and conflict is an atrocity that stands in the way of peace, prosperity, and gender equality. In Iraq and Syria, ISIL is making life hell for women and girls. The situation is especially grim for members of minority populations. Thousands of girls and women were abducted by ISIL last summer. Many, including girls as young as 7 or 8, were repeatedly raped and forced to marry ISIL fighters. Others have been sold as slaves. The United States is providing both humanitarian aid and other kinds of assistance. But the international community needs to do more to protect and better serve women and girls affected by the conflict. For example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, sexual violence has become a weapon that destroys lives, fuels conflict, and stands in the way of lasting peace. The U.S. is working to build a coherent approach to justice. Judges are holding open trials in local areas so witnesses can testify in their own communities. In turn, those communities can see firsthand that sexual violence will not go unpunished and that impunity will not be tolerated. Sexual violence and conflict continues to be a global problem that we need to address. In many headlines, women are portrayed as victims. And while there's no doubt that far too many women and girls are survivors of gender-based violence, it's not the whole story. Women are also incredible agents of change. They wield influence in their communities. They bring unique insights to decision-making tables. They increase the effectiveness of government. Gender-based violence, including sexual violence and conflict, holds women and girls back from participating fully in society. The repercussions negatively impact whole communities, halting development and leading to poorer educational, health, and economic outcomes. Tackling gender-based violence is crucial if we hope to unleash women's and girls' full potential and promote stability and economic growth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage.